Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I am here with my new friend at Macro Alf. And if you guys don't know this gentleman, he is going to blow you away. He was referred to me by Lynn Alden. I had the opportunity to interview him the other day for the George Gammon channel, the Rebel Capitalist Show, that went live last night. Everyone is ranting and raving about how great the interview was. And what's awesome about Mr. Alf is he's one of those people like Lynn or Joseph Wang or Jeff Snyder, where he really makes you think. And I think in today's day and age, we all need to do a lot more critical thinking and a lot less feeling in all areas of life, not just with macroeconomics. So welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on live.
It's always a pleasure, George, and thanks for the kind words. By the way, I think my top skill is sourdough bread and pizza, not macro, but we can talk about that later as well.
Well, if that's the case, then I'd love to taste your sourdough bread and pizza, because you're pretty good at macro, my friend.
But, hey,
you know, for my the people that are on the live stream right now, do you want to just go over your background briefly?
Sure. Let's do that. So for 7 years of my career, I've managed a $20 billion portfolio for a bank, large bank in Europe. And so I was responsible for this portfolio together with a team of three or four guys which were working for me. And we allocated capital mostly in fixed income, but also in equities and credits. So it was a large institutional portfolio, and that experience basically gave me the luxury to talk to prime ministers, central bankers, and to really see from the belly of the beast, literally within a bank, how certain mechanisms work, and as well get a lot of exposure to market flows, trading, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, I've just quit that job because way too much politics and way too much banking. And I moved to the rebel capitalist side of the equation. No, just kidding. I basically moved to the side of providing insights, macro insights. I write a newsletter now called The Macro Compass, where you can see most of the stuff that I push out. It's financial education, macro thoughts, and some investment ideas.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's dive into your most recent article, your most recent blog post. And again, guys, this is at, let's pull it up here. This is at The Macro Compass. .substack.com. And here you're talking about the real deal in the bond market. And this is really interesting. In fact, out of all the fascinating things to think about, all the exciting things to think about in the macro world right now, I think the yield curve is probably at the top of the list for me.
I agree.
Just because that's got such a good track record as far as its predictability with recession. And if we get a recession in the States, then you can see how that may impact risk assets, how that may impact the economy, et cetera. So going down here, do you want to intro? I've highlighted a couple paragraphs that I'd like to discuss, but do you want to intro the article and kind of why you wrote this? And then we'll go through those highlights and then check out some of your charts.
Yeah, love to do that, George. So this article is the second of my Bond Market 101 series, where I, as a professional bond market trader, basically try to teach you guys and walk you through the in and outs of the bond market. So the very first article was a 10,000 feet overview of the bond market. And then for each article, this is the second one, we're going to zoom in on a single topic. I did one back then on yield curve inversions, George. That's something that you are really interested to talk about. We can cover that. This one is about real interest rates that are so important as well in our economy. But so basically this is the second piece. More will be released about the repo market, for example, repo and reverse repo, how they work, from a guy who has literally done repo and reverse repo with banks and central banks. So I'll try to shed light as much as I can, all for free on the Macro Compass.
Yeah, you know, I love this quote that you start with, by the way, this Warren Buffett quote. When you combine ignorance and leverage, you get some pretty interesting results.
Isn't it? So,
boy, so, isn't that the truth?
And you know, basically, I decided to start with this because leverage is the backbone of our economy. It's like from the 80s to 2020, over the last 40 years, global debt to GDP, so a measure of the public sector and the private sector leverage as a percentage of the output we produce with that leverage, well, has actually increased a gazillion percent. We started in America in the 80s with aggregate private sector and public sector debt to GDP at about 120-130%. Right. If you sum up the private, so the corporate, the households, these guys, and the government debt, you now end up at 350%, 320%. So leverage is the name of the game. We lever up, George, because, you know, when you borrow from future purchasing power, you feel wealthier. You know, you just anticipate all your future purchasing power forward to today. And as long as this borrowing is cheap in real interest rate terms, it's all nice and dandy, right? So leverage, but also ignorance, are a pretty toxic combination. Warren Buffett said that, so you can trust him if you don't trust me.
How did we get here? I don't want to get too sidetracked, but yeah. It's just, you talked about how the debt has just absolutely exploded, not just on the government's balance sheet, but the consumer balance sheet, the corporate balance sheet. You've talked about how that just went parabolic since 1980 or 1981. Why? Why did it do that? Do you have any ideas?
Yeah. Oh, of course. So it all comes to what's socially acceptable for politicians and for the society to handle as growth rates. Before the 80s, the structural drivers of growth rates were actually doing pretty well. The most important one is labor supply, how many people enter the workforce. And why was labor supply doing so well before the 80s? It's the baby boomers. It's the post-Second World War demographic boom. So all these guys became 20, 25. And in the 70s, in the 80s, they entered the labor force at a very fast pace. Also, women started entering the labor force.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
So it all picked up. So the pie of the people contributing actively to final economic output actually went up by a large extent. And so that obviously drove economic growth, structural economic growth, something you can repeat over time and over time again. And the other driver of economic growth was productivity. It always is over the very long term. And so that productivity growth in the 70s and in the 80s was round about where it is today, about 1% per year. We become a little bit more productive year after year. But it was that labor supply, George, that actually gave that feeling of wealth. A lot of people entering the labor force, contributing, consuming. And those are, you know, those are structural forces. Come the 80s, though, the peak, the impulse of this labor supply growth stalled. And that's why you don't have any new boomers coming in, baby boomers becoming, entering the labor force. From the 80s onwards, the pace of growth of labor supply and world population started slow down. So we still grow the labor supply, but at a slowing and slowing and slowing pace. And so if productivity doesn't pick that slack up from
the labor... I'm sorry to cut you off right there, but just a thought before I forget. How does the labor force participation impact that?
Yeah, it's very important. So even if population growth is small, the labor supply can still grow if you take inactive people and you bring them in the labor force.
Right. Or if the population is increasing, like we see now, maybe with the millennial, the Gen, would it be Z? But yeah. We see labor force participation 2020, 2021 just plummeting. Yeah. Then, you know, that would have a negative impact on productivity, I'm guessing.
And then you have a problem, right? If these guys are there, they do exist, they're part of the population, but they do not actively contribute to the labor supply, then the participation rate is dropping. And in the 70s and the 80s, you had a double positive whammy. You had the pie, the amount of people growing because of, you know, the baby boomers and demographics trend in the 70s and in the 80s were okay. And also participation rate was popping up because women were entering the labor force. So from two sides, you had this very big push to the amount of people that were producing, to the labor supply. Now come the 80s though. Come the 80s and this push stops because the women have already entered the labor force, because the demographics boom has already happened. And so you start growing the population growth and the labor supply, but at a slower pace.
Right.
And so you can see that the engine of structural growth sort of slows down. Do politicians like that? No, they don't. Do society like that? Not really. We like to grow at a robust pace every year, right? We want our purchasing power to increase the robust pace. So what do we start to do, George? Politicians understand that after 71, when the gold standard was abolished, or, you know, there was no hard peg between the creation of new dollars and gold, when they understand our system allows freely to create new credit, literally out of thin air, without any hard asset pegging that, they say, well, I need more cyclical growth today. I don't have a labor supply growing at that pace and productivity. It's just what it is. So I'm going to create new credit. I'm going to literally create new dollars. I'm going to make this guy have now today more dollars via credit, via borrowing, than they would otherwise have just looking at their structural means of production.
And so, I want to artificially create additional consumption.
Yes.
Without having to have society produce anymore. Therefore, I'm just going to financialize the economy so we can consume more and more and more and more without producing.
This is just a perfect explanation. Yeah. Great summary. And then, you know what the problem is? Is that when you do that, unless the outlet of this credit creation is a productive investment, is something that over the long term increases your productivity, unless that is the case, this game is very hard to sustain, unless, again, the cost of this new borrowing goes down. Because if you borrow, George, and you do something not extremely productive, like financializing the economy and borrow to buy stocks or borrow to buy a house or whatever you borrow for, right? A second house or a third house. That obviously is a game you can keep on playing to increase today's consumption, also next year, if the cost of borrowing has gone down in real terms.
Right.
As you haven't produced more structural growth by buying houses, you just push the house price up. That's what you do. If you want this trend to continue, the guy who has to access new credit, not in 1980s, but in 1985 and in 1990, he needs that credit to be cheaper. Or otherwise, the equation is not going to hold up together. And guess what we have done? We have exactly done that. Real interest rates. In the 90s, if you had a mortgage rate, a 30-year mortgage rate in America in the 90s, in real terms, was about 7%. In 2021, it went all the way down to 1%. And a 6% drop in 30-year real borrowing costs, that's massive. It makes you able, through a wealth illusion effect, to borrow much more today, even if your salary hasn't gone up much, even if your productivity hasn't gone up much. It makes you able to borrow because it's so cheap to borrow, right? So every time we create new credit, debt to GDP goes from 120 to 320%, summing up the public sector and the private sector. And we make every time credit cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so that's the game we're playing, right?
And so now we need negative real rates just to sustain that.
Pretty much. So there's a rate that I explain in the article. It's called the equilibrium interest rate. So basically, the policymakers are like this dog trying to keep the entire system in equilibrium.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like this dog. You see, they're very good at it. They're very good at it. They're very good at it till they are not. Yeah. So yeah. Basically, that's the situation.
Right.
So if you scroll down a bit more in the article, George, you will see the definition of this R star. Here you go. So
this chart right here. I want to focus on this. Okay.
Yeah. So basically, guys, what the heck is this R star? So it's the equilibrium real interest rate. It's non-observable. You have to estimate it. And all the central bankers are trying to estimate that. What it is the rate at which the economy doesn't overheat, doesn't underheat, generates stable inflation and stable growth. Stable as in potential growth, you know, with the means it normally has for production. Doesn't overheat, doesn't go into recession. It just does its job. And so if I estimate this rate in inflation-adjusted terms in America, do you know how much that is now? Zero, George, zero.
Right, right.
That's the real interest rate that the American economy can sustain without going into a recession. Because if it's higher than that, the American economy doesn't have the structural power to roll over all this debt that it has and the more expensive real interest rates.
Yeah, right.
So the driver of these natural equilibrium interest rates are the ones you see in this chart.
And look. Before you go on there, because I know a lot of people are going to be thinking, well, who cares what happens because I've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage.
Hmm.
And so it doesn't apply to me. And what those people are missing, in my opinion, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is yes, you do have that interest rate locked in. So the higher interest rates, if we go that direction, don't affect you directly, but they do affect someone who wants to buy your house.
Yeah, that is true.
And so although your payment might not be affected, your home equity most likely will be over the long run if we see ever increasing interest rates, or if the Fed does what the market thinks it's going to do by increasing interest rates 7 times in 2022, as an example.
So even if George, I mean, again, exactly on the spot, if you have a 30-year fixed mortgage rate, if interest rates go up by 10%, you personally don't care. When it comes to your monthly installments, your monthly mortgage installments are not going to change.
Right.
Your house price, guys, that is going to change. That is going to change. And you have to think in terms that people have a second house, they rent it out. And so when they rent it out, they look at it as a fixed cash flow. The renter is paying the cash flow. I can cover the mortgage with it or something like that. I'm fine. You have a mortgage attached to that and a risk, which is that the renter is not going to pay. And so if your equity, if your mark to market in the house price goes down, you are going to make financial decisions in a much different way than you are going to make when you feel wealthy, because the equity that you own in the house, even if you haven't crystallized yet, is so much large. Mm-hmm. Coming back to this equilibrium interest rates. So the drivers of these equilibrium interest rates, look at the blue stock. The blue stock is by far the most important. This is from a paper of the European Central Bank. I'm not making this up. They are telling you what drives this equilibrium real interest rate. So the blue line is something called the blue stock, something called labor quantity. Right. Number of people in the labor force, age 15-64. Key driver. So even if your population grows, but it grows older, it ages at the same time, George, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anymore because those people are retired. They don't contribute anymore to the workforce. What right. you're looking for is a demographic boom that then produces 20 years later a lot of people entering the labor force. That's what you're looking for. Now, this chart shows for Europe what the ECB think the impact of the blue stock and the other stocks we're going to cover is going to be on the equilibrium interest rate. Look at the blue stocks. They're going down. They're going down quick.
Right.
The European labor force is shrinking, guys. It's shrinking. It is very difficult to generate long-term sustainable growth rates. If you have less people delivering every year, you have less people contributing. So obviously, the equilibrium interest rates at which the entire system holds together have to be lower, because your capacity to generate growth goes down. Less people on an aggregate level are contributing to the workforce. In the US, these blue stocks for the next 10 years are going to be round about zero. So thanks to immigration, net immigration, the US manages to keep afloat. But the US population in terms of labor quantity will also go down. China goes down. Russia goes down. Japan goes down. Why is that? Because the population ages. So people become 65, they abandon the labor force. Where is the substitution effect? Birth rates per women have dropped materially from the 70s. Where is the substitution effect? There is no substitution effect. And so what happens then is that you as a Federal Reserve or the ECB, you are seeing this equilibrium real interest rates drop. And the only thing you can do is expand your balance sheet, is drop your Fed funds rate to make the real interest rates minus 1%, minus 2%. So that even if the equilibrium is zero, George, and the prevailing real interest rates in the economy is minus 1%, that's still okay, right? Now, the problem is that when you can't push these real interest rates down anymore that easily, what are you going to do? Because the equilibrium doesn't move. The equilibrium remains zero, or in Europe, it's negative. As a central bank, how are you going to remain accommodative? How are you going to stimulate? It's hard to push real interest rates to minus 2, 3, 4%. You can do it, but then inflation expectations have to be higher. People have to expect inflation to be 4%, 5% over the foreseeable future. And if you do that, George, then you also have problems as a policymaker, because inflation expectations are becoming de-anchored. They don't like this word, de-anchored on the upside, because then people start to think, whoa, okay, so if I expect inflation to be 4 or 5% over the next 10 years, I want my wage to grow as well, minimum 4 to 5% every year. So the famous wage price spiral effect might actually kick in. And so bringing these real interest rates down below the equilibrium levels becomes more and more and more difficult. And Japan is the perfect example of that. They aren't managing this anymore. They're growing at around about zero every single year.
How did the I got a couple questions here. How did the countries that defaulted by inflating away their debt once they got over 100% debt to GDP, how did they do that? Because I'm sitting, as you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking about, okay, we need negative real rates, or at least the central planners think we need negative real rates. Okay, well, once they get down to zero, that just means that even at zero, I guess, they would still need to increase some level or produce some level of inflation.
Yeah.
So how do they do that if the only way to create inflation is through government deficit spending, which increases the debt to GDP even further? So, and I'm going back, I'm referencing a study that I know that Lynn referenced in her recent blog post, where they looked at 51 countries going back to 1800, and 50 of them defaulted once their debt got over 100%. Now, the question was, did they default via just giving the creditors a haircut, or did they default through inflation? And it was really dependent upon if the country's debt was denominated in their own currency. But yes, for those countries that had their own currency and they kind of took the path of least resistance by a soft default, if you will, mm-hmm. how did they do that when the debt level gets so high? How did they create sufficient negative real rates?
Yes. So it's a super valid question. And the math to deflate your debt away is very difficult to achieve.
Yeah.
So basically, you need to generate fiscal deficits that are large enough such that inflationary pressures go up by more than the fiscal deficits you're printing every year.
Yeah.
So if you do a fiscal deficit of 5%, then nominal growth, so the sum of GDP rates and inflation, needs to go up by more than that every single year. And you need to repeat this exercise and keep the real interest rates below these costs as well. Yeah. So let me
say that just so everyone's following us, because it's just crucially important. I've really been giving this a lot of thought the last few days. So guys, what happens if we take GDP, let's just say that it's 100, mm-hmm. and let's just say that the deficit as a percentage of GDP goes up by 20%. Yeah. So this, if 100 is a unit of measurement, then that would be, if it goes up 20%, now we're at 120, right? So that would be the amount of debt increase, because that was a percentage of GDP. So the nominal GDP would have to go up at a higher rate than 20% in yes. order to achieve what the government needs to in a deleveraging to get the debt to GDP back down to a more sustainable level. So let me give you a concrete example. Back in 2021, I think December, year over year, nominal GDP was about 11.7%. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is if the deficit as a percentage of GDP was at 12%, then that inflation doesn't matter. That's not going to help your debt to GDP. And you get in this kind of trap where the more money that the government spends to create the inflation, the higher the percentage to GDP. And if we don't get velocity, if the dollars don't circulate, then the government just prints more and more and more and more. But the problem just gets worse and worse and worse.
Pretty much correct. And it's even a little bit worse than that, George, because you made the right comparison, because the fiscal deficits increase your debt totally every year. And then your GDP growth need to grow more than that, and more also than the interest payments in real terms that you have to face on this debt. Don't forget that. So you need to push these real interest rates very, very much down, then print 5% deficit and make sure that nominal growth is higher than 5% every single year.
So how have countries done that in the past?
So they've done that. The thing about the past is that a lot of people try to look at it, but there is a crucial difference. if the US had done this exercise, and they have done it relatively successfully during the, let's say, the Second World War period in the 40s, right? They have done this 10-year period between the 40s and the beginning of the 50s where they have achieved that. The material difference is basically that the government, without the help of the economy, without the help of the government, was already able to generate pretty decent growth. So you start from a different perspective. You start from a place where if real interest rates are zero, just to say, then the economy can already do 3% growth. If you pump 5% deficit, then the economy can do more than that. And so it's a little bit easier to achieve that. But if your structural growth is zero or 1% and your real interest rates, where do you want to push them? Because remember, policymakers, George, they don't like extreme things. You can say whatever you want, but the post-Second World War is a reconstruction period, is an extremely special period where politicians might justify certain things because of war or post-war period. Today, they did a huge job when it comes to printing deficits to fill income holes. They did way too much, actually, so we see the results now, inflation, etc. But it's a crisis tool. It's a crisis tool. Ask them now in Washington, D.C., if they want to do the same exercise with CPI at 7.5%.
So CARES Act 2.0, $5 trillion deficit spending with CPI at 7.5.
I'm sorry, but they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. I had the chance to talk to a former G10 prime minister. I'm very lucky with my former job. I manage a lot of money, so a lot of people wanted to talk to me. All right, cool. So this guy, I asked him, I can't say his name. But okay, so I asked the guy, can you please tell me why you are not putting out policies that are structurally positive for your economy? And he's like, for example, I don't know, boost the education system, make people more productive, make people more knowledgeable. What you are doing, George, what you are doing should be compulsory high school stuff. I mean, give me a break. And so they don't do this. And I'm like, why the heck are you not increasing financial education, infrastructure quality, you know, those things that actually deliver long-term returns?
Right.
And the guy looked at me like, if I do this, you know, 20 years, the next guy will benefit from it, but I won't be in politics anymore, or I won't be reelected the next turn because of these policies. Nobody will see the effects. Yeah. And so you do understand they think in crisis reaction. They think in something is happening outside my comfort zone. I need to bring it back to my comfort zone. The comfort zone of politicians is not to print 7-8% deficits every year. It's not to see CPI at 8%. That's not their comfort zone. That's not their comfort zone. So it's a very difficult game. The math is already complicated. You pointed it out. And then there is the managing to be not in the tail events that policymakers hate. Tail catastrophe events where they're in the spotlight. They don't want to be in the spotlight. Just want the status quo to run. That's what they want. And so the combination of the two makes deflating the debt away a pretty difficult exercise, actually.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Do
just thinking about it another way, if we're assuming that deficits are going up, there's a good chance that the percentage of government spending as a percentage of GDP is going up. And yeah. for most of the people on this channel right now, they realize that the government is going to spend money far less efficiently or productively than the private sector. So if you have the percentage of government spending going from 40% to 50% to 60%, then the economy is going to be less productive, and therefore it's going to be harder and harder to create the inflation needed to get the negative interest rates.
Pretty much true. So there's a positive side and a negative side in this public versus private discussion. So private debt is inherently less stable and more problematic than public debt. And the reason why I say that, George, is imagine if the listeners here have five mortgages, right? And they have a lot of debt. And so it's 2007 all over again. We rent out houses, we have five mortgages and all of that, right? That's an inherently unstable situation because it takes a little bit of stoppage in the economy somewhere. You cannot print away or refinance your mortgage easily unless you have the cash flows to sustain that mortgage, right? Or that very high leverage. And so the private sector needs economic growth to be levered up. It needs the entire system to work and be oiled well. On the other hand, the government doesn't actually need that. The government balance sheet works in quite a different way compared to the private sector balance sheet. You said it before. Countries that have a very high debt to GDP level, but they have monetary sovereignty. They yeah. have issued yeah. debt in their own domestic currency. They are the monopoly issuer of that currency, guys. They can just say, I need to fill a hole. I'm going to issue more of this currency to fill the hole that I've created. They have the powers to do that. The only problem is that if the population doesn't trust that currency to be a proper store of value, a proper mean of exchange, they don't expect $1 to be worth $1. They don't expect their real purchasing power to be relatively stable, then you might have some problems. That is more of an emerging market sort of situation where people are very used to this, deflating away and printing away. See Turkey. Turkey is a typical example.
Argentina, or even Colombia, where I am right now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there are so many of these episodes that people start to say, okay, well, yeah, you know, and also Argentina has dollar denominated debt.
Oh, right.
Turkey has dollar denominated debt. Turkey can't print dollars. Turkey can't print dollars. Argentina can't print dollars. So they have inherently this problem. America can print dollars, and they only have dollar denominated debt, basically, which makes their life much easier in refinancing, even if the productive part of the economy underlying this debt. It's not that strong, but they have this power. The private sector doesn't have this power. I cannot print.
I still don't see how they could just, okay, let's just, okay, we'll go the MMT route. And yes, the government is the currency issuer. They're not the currency user.
Correct.
But I still don't see how they could just flip a light switch and take inflation, let's just say as measured by the CPI, up to 10 or 15% just at will. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how, even if they just, let's just say, did the stimmy checks again, okay, that goes up temporarily, but then you get right back to where, and prices do go up, but then they go up in flatline. They just go up to a higher plateau. I don't know how you get this sustained level of inflation unless you get velocity, unless Gresham's law kicks in, and then people are like, I don't want these pieces of paper at all. Yes. I want to get rid of it. The savings rate goes down. Everyone spends, and then the GDP does go up without the politicians having to do much other than just kind of stoke that fire. Another thing that I've given a lot of thought of about that I'd love your opinion on. I think where we're headed is a central bank digital currency. Mm-hmm. And because to me, this gives the politicians a very, I don't want to use the word elegant, but we'll call it a clever solution. Because if we all have an account at the Fed, then the Fed can directly insert dollars into the real economy and circumnavigate the banking system. and also the government. But, and I think we might have spoken about this the other day, but what we didn't talk about, I don't think, was the fact that that also creates dollars without affecting the balance sheet of the government. It doesn't affect it at all. All of a sudden, you can have all this basically government spending without having to issue treasuries. Because the Fed can do it by just creating bank reserves, which now actually are dollars that are circulating in the real economy. And so I think that because of this conundrum that we're talking about, they're going to get to a point where they realize that that's their only way out. And that's why I think the probability is pretty high within the next 5 years or so that they go down that path, forgetting about all the other, you know, 1984 stuff that would go along with it. But what are your thoughts on the central bank digital currency?
It's an interesting experiment that is promoted by the central bank circles. I had the chance to speak to, as if, you know, it's just a tool on the side, and it increases, what did they tell me? It increased the amount of people that are banked, because there are still unbanked people. And so with CBDC, they don't have to go to commercial bank. They can open an account straight away to the Federal Reserve or to the ECB. So it's sold as an inclusion mechanism.
Yeah, this
story. Complete crap. The reality is exactly what you're saying. So the reality is that CBDCs have two functions. The first, it's going to be the first one to be implemented, is that you can still have an account at a commercial bank, and then you can choose to have an account at ECB or the Fed. Now, tell me, George, in Europe, you are insured on your counterparty losses by depositing money at a commercial bank up to 100,000 euro. If you have anything above that and the bank goes belly up, then it's your problem. Literally, it's your problem. Now, there is a much higher chance that the central bank will go belly up. So naturally, you basically eliminate your counterparty risk almost completely by opening an account to the ECB.
Much lower.
I'm sorry. You reduce this counterparty risk, because the central bank is not going to go belly up, right? Much more difficult than it does than a single commercial bank. So they will be sold as coexistent, but in reality, it's a very harsh competition for banks. You will be incentivized to open an account to the ECB. So you will see how the CBDC work. The first thing they're going to try and do is apply. So first of all, if you do CBDCs, then forget about cash. It's basically gone. Already today, right. It's an extremely small portion of the spendable money in the economy. Yeah. Cash account only in Europe accounts for 3% of the spendable money in circulation. All the rest is commercial bank deposits. I pay you, my bank credits your account, or your bank debits my account. It's all a bank deposit exchange. It's a ledger exchange. Right. And cash only accounts for 3%. CBDC, cash is going to account for 0%. So which also means that the European Central Bank might say, okay, so we want to cut rates to -3%. Today, it's very hard for them to do so, because if they do so, people will just go to the ATMs of each commercial bank they can. They will withdraw all these bank deposits. They will turn them into physical cash as much as they can. And they will say, look, I mean, insurance cost and storage costs and all of that of these bills is much less expensive than -3% a year. You want to charge me on my digital bank deposits. So sorry, but I'm not going to allow that.
Right.
If they eliminate cash, that's much easier to achieve. And also they might say, I want to apply -3% to this cohort of the population that has a high spending habit. So these are the guys with more velocity, basically. So I want them really to get out and spend this CBDC, this digital bank deposit. They can do it targeted.
So individual monetary policy down to the individual level.
I mean, at least at the beginning, will be like for cohorts of people. They will identify who they want a certain rate to be directed to and who not. And the ultimate game is what you described. That's a very deep thinking there. Today, the Federal Reserve, when they do QE, creates bank reserves and buys bonds with it. And then those bonds are taken away from the system. So they were sitting on, for example, a bank balance sheet. They're now taken away. The bank finds itself with this stupid bank reserves. They can't do much with it. It's an interbank form of money. Go back to the CBDC. They would be like, okay, guys, We, the Fed, are not going to wait for JP Morgan to decide that they can lend to the real economy. We want to take over some of that credit creation capacity. So we're going to basically make these bank reserves legal tender. We're going to say now the liability side of the Federal Reserve balance sheet is literal money you can spend in the real economy. Today, yeah. That's not the case.
Asset side of the average Joe and Jane balance sheet.
Exactly. So it moves directly straight away to your asset side. Yep. And the asset side of you guys is what you can spend. Today, when the Fed does QE, you don't get these bank reserves. You guys don't get it. You cannot buy bread with these bank reserves. You have to hope that JP Morgan says, because bank reserves are so large, I feel my liquidity is so comfortable, I'm going to lend more to the real economy. That's right. What you hope for today. Right. But the reality is that JP Morgan is not going to lend to you guys if JP Morgan doesn't make a return, if JP Morgan is capital constrained, regulation constrained, things you're already too leveraged. It's not going to lend to you. The Federal Reserve with CBDC can just say, I want George to get more money. Go, George, yours. Do something with it.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's very similar to what the Bank of Japan did with the Ministry of Finance back in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. If you read Werner's book, you know, The Princes of the Yen.
Yeah.
And I just had him at Rebel Capitalist Live. He's a great, great guy. But I think that's kind of what effectively that's what they did. I think they'll also incentivize people to set up those accounts by just doing a universal basic income. If you download the Fed app, if you will, so they can start directing that money into the economy. I think they could give it a time horizon as to when you have to spend it to increase velocity to the level they need. And what most people, I don't think they've thought through, is how the going back to what we were saying. Let's go back to GDP at 100% at 100. And if they're doing this, then effectively you're having government spending without issuing treasuries. Therefore, the deficit would be zero. Would be zero. And therefore, if the deficit is zero, any increase in nominal GDP is going to bring down the debt to GDP, which is one of their objectives.
George, you literally take away all this social construct we have, these complex constructs where we have the government balance sheet interacting with the Fed balance sheet, interacting with your balance sheet at the end of the day, right? You take all of that away and you say there's a Fed balance sheet, the Fed takes over, the central bank takes over, also the credit creation capacities. Not only the liquidity can literally now create new spendable money. Forget right. Financing with debt, treasuries, then a bank has to buy them, then they get a swap from, forget all of that. They can just say, we are the currency monopoly issuer. That's true, by the way. And instead of using the government as the issuing arm and making all this complicated, I'm going to cover my debt with the treasury. Forget about that. I'm just going to create new credit. I'm going to move it from my liability side, Federal Reserve, to the asset side of the consumers. And then I'm going to also incentivize them pretty strong in what I want them to do with this newly created credit. Right. When do I want it to spend it? How much do I want it to spend it? What is the interest rate they have to pay? It's going to be negative interest rate if they really want you to spend it. How much am I going to charge you, George, for not paying it? They can apply it overnight. They don't need this monetary transmission mechanism that we have today where they do something and then a commercial bank has to adjust via committees. I was sitting in one of these committees. Geez, man, you know, the CEO and then the CIO and then the CFO and all these guys have to be in and the risk manager has to discuss. Forget all of that. It's a much more direct form. And Professor Werner is a great guy. I agree with you because he sees this so clearly. And Japan in the 80s had done a similar experiment without changing all the infrastructure because you need to change the entire infrastructure to move to the extent we're discussing. What they did is so-called credit windows. That's how they're called. Right. China has them too today. It's basically the regulator, the policymaker, the government walks to the bank and says, you need to lend this amount to that sector.
Or you're fired.
Or you have a problem. And so then the bank says, okay, then I'm going to lend. And that's what happens in China, used to happen in Japan as well. It's basically central planning. That's all it is. And it's a much more direct version, less democratized version, if you wish, of the very difficult construct we have created with money nowadays.
I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but I would like to get your thoughts on the collateral side of repo.
Okay.
Because, you know, when we're talking about the government not issuing any more treasuries, T-bills, as an example, because we've got this new MMT magic wand of a central bank digital currency, how does that apply to repo, where you've got $4 trillion a day going back and forth, and they're heavily dependent upon more and more pristine collateral, i.e. treasuries? Do you think that's why the Fed set up like the standing repo facility, so the Fed could kind of monopolize the repo market if they need to because of a lack of collateral in the future?
George, you don't need my answers. You're so smart. You know them all already. Yeah, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
So the standing repo facility is basically the Federal Reserve putting a sort of a layer, a put or a cap, whatever you want to call it, or a floor.
Just backstopping.
Just backstopping it. It's like, okay, guys, if it goes above this level, we are not going to accept it. We are going to provide you with either as much reserves, cash, whatever you need, or as much collateral as you need. Both ways, no problem. So basically, there's a fixed corridor because the Federal Reserve is able at any time, digitally, literally digitally, to provide now both sides, because their balance sheet is so big, they can provide treasuries if needed, if that is the problem, or they can provide the other side, which is reserves.
Yeah, in other words, reverse repo or repo.
So they basically, their tools when it comes to digitally providing either collateral or reserves are so big, the balance sheet is so big, and the Fed can create reserves anytime they want, any way they want. It's our system works. It's a digital ledger system, guys. Yeah, right. So it can literally be created like this. So if you move to CBDC, then wow, that's a game changer. I mean, you need the Fed to be so into the repo market that the transition from the collateral side is going to disappear. I mean, what are these treasuries? We don't need them anymore, right? I mean, we just have the Fed that can literally move money, credit, not, you know, literally like spendable money to George's account without all this complication of the treasury issuing a bond and then the bond gets bought by somebody else. And forget about all of that. George is right, though, that if you remove all the collateral from the new source of collateral, which is fiscal deficits, that's how the collateral gets into the system. Right. It's fiscal deficits and euro dollars. Some Jeff Snyder is a magician. I'm going to have a chat with him next week. I'm so looking forward.
Oh, good. Are you going on Emil's show with Jeff?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, let me know when that comes out so I can retweet it. I would love to listen to that. That's going to be awesome. You're going to be on Making Sense.
Yeah, we're going to have a chat with Jeff. I think that is the show, because Emil reached out to me to arrange that. So euro dollars is the other way with which dollars are created, interestingly, outside the U.S. jurisdiction. So it's a very fragile system where new dollars can be created. And so that is also collateral that can be used to rehypothecate transactions via repo. The Fed needs to have a very tight grip on all of that if you're going to transition from a point where there is no collateral anymore being provided. So one side of the repo equation dries up, and that's a serious problem.
Yeah, well, but it seems like the Fed has what they think is a solution. Well, I mean, we'll have to see how it plays out. Often, you know, what looks good on paper doesn't pan out in practice. The first thing I think of there is like going from LIBOR to SOFR. You know, we'll have to see how that plays out over the long run. But okay, guys, let's get into some questions for Alf. Nicola, what's up, my friend? You're Hello. On with Alf.
My question is mostly about CBDC. Is it going to be maybe something like they did in El Salvador with El Chivo app, with a wallet that they created? Because I feel that every currency needs faith of the people to work. So, like, even if
how do you guys have the same accent? Are you from the same
place? I'm from Serbia.
Where are you from, Alf?
Italy. So not that far.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Stupid, ignorant American question. Okay.
So my question is like, maybe they're going to do the same approach, buy some Bitcoin as like a reserve. Uh-huh. And then issue on top of that, just issue CBDC.
Okay, this is a very deep question. And you make a great point, because if a central planner would say, Nicola is your name, right? If central planner would say tomorrow, Nicola, we have this new currency, all of a sudden it's produced by the same central planners, no difference. So instead of commercial banks and the government printing this new currency every time, now we are going to take over all of that, literally all of that. And we're going to decide when to print, how to print it, how to charge you, and when do you... They're going to say like, okay, wait. That sounds a lot like China-like style. That's way too much centrally planned. Where is my control? I mean, are those, by the way, democratically elected institutions? Can I vote for these guys who are controlling all of this all at once? So what you will be demanding, I guess, almost from an instinct point of view, is something that guarantees, it's a higher layer that guarantees that this process is somehow fair. Right? Controllable, fair. And so in the past, do you know how we did that? Gold. That's how we guaranteed that. There was a price at which you could switch these newly created magic digital ledgers for something hard that everybody believed it had a hard value.
Right.
That's how we used to do it. And now then we abolished that because we soon realized that we couldn't produce all this credit, because then there were way too many dollars and the gold wasn't going up. Gold, I mean, gold as in the bars
physical
of gold
bar
available were not increasing. So we have already tried pegging this funny digital system that we have to something hard, and it doesn't work because it can't work. Whoever creates money, CBDC via central planner, or today, which is the government with fiscal deficits and the banks when they lend you money into existence, it's always the same problem, because you will have to create new money from a certain source, and you cannot peg it either to Bitcoin or gold. Otherwise, you're going to have 1971 again. It's going to be the same problem.
Maybe, but I think that there is a difference between Bitcoin. Bitcoin, you can manage like the price. The price is much more manageable based on how many miners and how big is the hash rate, etc. It's based like on the literal electric power that you can output to the system to support the system, and which country is supporting the most, and etc. So I think that they can maybe go away with it. You don't think so?
No, because gold also has limited supply. And so the amount of gold that we can dig from Earth literally increases by about, I think, 2 or 3% a year, no more than that. So you could make the same argument by saying, you know, you can sort of, because gold sits on each of these large institutions' balance sheet already, they could find an agreement to control the price of gold under which we would peg all the newly created money.
Yes.
The problem is just the supply and demand. So as the supply of this newly created credit increases, if the amount of the hard asset you're trying to peg this against cannot increase, almost by definition. In Bitcoin, it just can't increase after a certain point. And in gold, it can increase by this little every year. You're still going to have this imbalance effect. So you can try to maneuver it around for a bit. That's what we did with the gold standard for 20 years. We tried to maneuver this around a bit, but at some point it just explodes.
But again, if you say that like Bitcoin increase at the same time as you increase your currency, your inflation, if you increase Bitcoin price at 3% a year and inflation is 3% a year, you effectively cheat the system. Because it's Nicola, like you don't have to print another Bitcoin. You don't have to create another coin.
I understand.
You just need to change the price.
Let's go back to your initial question. You asked for a way to trust this whole process. And now it's a circling argument, because you're basically talking about controlling the price of the thing that would give you the trust into this whole process to be fair.
Yes.
So as you can see, if you manipulate gold or Bitcoin price, or you find a way to do that, you're defying your own same question, aren't you?
Yes. Fair enough. Thank you.
Welcome.
Nicola has a fantastic question, my friend.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, and thanks for watching the show. All right, Josh, do we have anyone else? No, I think that's it. Okay, well, we were going to go about 15 or 20 minutes, Alf, and we've gone 53 minutes. So, I'm sorry for keeping you so long, but boy, that was really a fun conversation. And we had almost 700 people on the live stream, so I'm sure everyone just got a ton of value. So thanks for your time. Where can the viewers find out about what you do? You want to repeat your website, the Substack, and then where can they find you on Twitter?
Yeah. So basically the article we're analyzing at the beginning, it's from my newsletter. It's free. It's the link is now in the chat. It's called the Macro Compass at .substack.com. That's where I post my articles. Once a week, I give you guys some macro insights, some financial education material. Basically, the things we have discussed with George today, unpacked for you guys. Every week, there is a new topic. And then you can find me on Twitter, at macroalf is my Twitter handle. And just keep on following George. I mean, these interviews are so good, man. It's great what you do.
Awesome conversation. I'm just about ready to go to lunch after this. So I've got so much going on in my head that I'm going to have to take a notepad with me to lunch just so I can jot down, everything so I can think it through later. So again, thanks for your time, buddy. And for the viewers, always remember to stand up for freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism. We'll see you in the next video.
Ciao, guys.